Happy Tuesday, foodies. A little PSA, if you hear an email go off during this podcast, it is your email, not mine. Again, I'd like to emphasize that it is your email playing in your headphones and not mine because I forgot to put it on silent. So anyways, I have yet another kick-ass female entrepreneur for you this week. Ellen Marie Bennett is the brains behind successful company Hedley & Bennett, a culinary brand that offers premium quality aprons, kitchen gear, and much more to come, which we talked about. I enjoyed every second of this conversation with Ellen. We chatted about her Mexican and English heritage, what it's like to be a bit of an outsider, and dug deep into one of her most exciting activations, her newest series coming on May 28th with Tastemade and Andrew Zimmern's production company, which is focused on kitchen design. So please join me in welcoming the incredible, the wonderful, the lovely Ellen Marie Bennett. Really great to meet you, and you have a lot of incredible and exciting things going on, including a new baby on the way I saw, so I'm excited to dive into all of it. Very exciting times.
Yes, it's wild over here. I'm like bracing for impact of a baby coming out of me in 2 weeks.
2 weeks? Is that how soon?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, when I made you sit here dealing with technical difficulties, you should be laying down.
Oh gosh, I know. It's all good.
So funny. All right, so I want to start with your heritage background. I always kind of like to dive into that a little bit so we can get to know you a little bit more. I was reading an interview where you said you grew up in the U.S. here in L.A., but you would visit Mexico 3 to 4 times a month, especially to visit your grandma. What was it like going back and forth like that? Was it a bit of a culture shock each time, or was it an easy transition for you?
No, it's kind of like that's the only world I knew was the mix. And so I think in my spirit and in the way I approach life in general, I kind of have that same mixed vibe of, you know, I can pull it together and I can also just like run around the streets playing soccer barefoot. Like I'm pretty comfortable in new territories and in stuff that isn't perfect and buttoned up. And, but yet I can also, you know, be in a room with, you know, executives, but I can also hang out with, you know, whatever, play soccer again. Like it's just, I think what it really taught me was just how to be very malleable to life and whatever your circumstances are. Like it doesn't really matter where you are. It's like the people around you, are they great people or not, and how do you like interact with them? And so I think I learned how to interact with all sorts of different types of peeps from both worlds.
So it kind of made you, or at least allowed you, immerse yourself in both cultures, and you find it okay, or at least maybe in your adulthood, you can assimilate a little bit more easily. Is that what you kind of mean?
Yeah, like I think, you know, when you have one perspective on one world and one neighborhood and these kids at school, and that is all you know, that you assume that the whole world is like that. And the fact that I grew up being in LA with kids that, you know, maybe all wanted to be actors or directors or whatever. And like, that just wasn't everybody in the world. Then I went to Mexico and I would be with kids and friends that, you know, maybe they had a nice house, maybe they had a dirt floor. Like it didn't actually matter. They were so radically different from the people I knew in LA that it wasn't jarring to me or shocking to me that people had different points of view. I guess that's really what it came down to. And so I recognized how to be okay with knowing people with very different ways of living in life and not expecting that everybody should be or think the same way or look the same or act the same. And that to me has been like a really great kind of gift because, you know, I went from like culinary school to being a cook, like a $11 an hour cook, but now I like run a company. Like I think that there's been more flexibility in where and how I show up, and I'm just kind of willing to talk to people from any background, and I'm not like, oh, you're not of a certain level, or you're, I don't know how to talk to you because you're of a certain, it, like, that is literally obsolete. Like, it doesn't exist in my world. Whereas if all you know is your one neighborhood and your one town and your one type of people and your friends from high school, like, that's a pretty skinny perspective.
Right. Right. I wonder too, if growing up in LA, especially like you said, the actors and the models, was it at all isolating to you when you found that those weren't generally your interests, or because you were able to travel to Mexico and do all those things, you kind of got the freedom to explore what you're interested there?
Yeah, no, it was 100% isolating. I was totally like the weird kid at school that had giant hair. They would call me cave woman, and it was really mean. Oh, no. And I know, because I had really curly hair, but I hadn't learned how to embrace my curls. But I guess my point is, like, I definitely grew up being a little bit of, like, not the girl that was popular and in the mix, and I was walking to the beat of my own drum, and I have always walked to the beat of my own drum. And it was something that, because I got to separate myself from LA and go to Mexico, is like, I would go with my people. Like, it was this place where it was comfortable, and it was okay to be loud, and it was okay to be into food, and that was just totally normal. So yeah, I loved it. I loved that. It really helped me a lot. And then when I grew up a little bit more and I turned 18, I was like, fuck it. Let's go to Mexico City for a month or two. And I stayed for 4 years. And that was a huge part of my own growing phase of life, and like learning to find my own sea legs. And all of my friends were going off to colleges and taking a really kind of like straight and narrow path to the typical thing you do to have a career. And I was like, it's like I got in a boat and was like rowing off to Cuba or something. Like, everybody was like, what are you doing? And it was what was right for me. It's not right for everyone, but I think I've just had a windy path from the get-go. So I appreciate the unknown more than the known.
Oh, for sure. And I feel you on the curly hair thing. I used to be bullied for that in third grade too. And now look at me now.
Yeah, exactly. Now people pay big money for our curls.
I know. They always wish. They're like, oh, I wish I had curly hair. And I always wished I had straight hair. And sometimes I still find myself wishing that, just because it's easier to maintain. And it's just like, oh, I'd love to wake up in the morning and just roll out of bed and have it literally look luscious, like Blake Lively or something and whatever. But that's never been my life. So now I feel like I'm finally embracing it a little bit more. Totally. But I mean, it triggers you when you're young, when people make fun of your appearance and you already feel like you're not fitting in and you're already going through such an awkward time. And then people point it out.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah, no, it's tough. And you, in it, like, if you are unique, it makes you feel like you should be more like them. And so you're kind of hiding your special sauce and your uniqueness. And, you know, for whatever, it was probably a combination of the way my mom raised us and the fact that I was very much like a lock key child. I didn't really hang out that much with kids because my mom just was working all day and needed to take care of my sister. So I was just put in a lot of situations where I didn't have the opportunity to even go down that rabbit hole. And so I just stayed my, you know, kooky self and practiced cooking at home and like painted walls in my mom's house and like redesigned her living room. I just did things that you wouldn't, I guess, normally be doing when you're 13 or 14. And it was a gift, but I definitely, if I think of myself at that moment in my journey at 13 years old, I was like, this sucks. I suck. You know, there was nothing pretty about it. And so it's important to just kind of like zoom out later and recognize that at that moment you were actually learning some like deep skills, even though it was really hard, uncomfortable, boring, awful, didn't feel good. I persisted through it. And then I got to a place where now it's like one of my skills. Like, I'm like, yeah, I can fit in any environment. I can adapt. I can change. I want to be different. In fact, I don't want to be like anyone else. Our brand is very unique because I lean into not being like other brands because I feel proud and confident in that mindset.
As you should. And people will call you crazy until you're, quote, successful by America's standards. And then you're all of a sudden you're not crazy.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I was reading, and you touched upon this earlier, but in that same interview I was talking about, you quoted, "To be honest, I enjoyed those meals more than sitting in a friend's fancy home in the United States, where everyone is a lot more serious, a little more sterile, and without like the liveliness of Mexico." So you seem to be kind of trying to intertwining those two cultures at the same time. What did food represent to you at that time?
Well, I think food is this thing that everybody does. Everyone needs to eat always, right?
Correct.
And it is a through line. It's a common theme, right? So whether you have a lot of money or don't have a lot of money, like you got to find a way, whether it's beans and rice and tortillas, which I love deeply, or it's a
Oh, me too.
steak. Like, I don't know. It's something everyone's doing. So I love that it is the through line of the two different cultures that I grew up with and these very different people all gathered around food anyway. Just some people showed up differently at the table, and I just happened to like it when people are a lot more enthusiastic and outright and forthright and kind of, you know, more I don't know, extra. Like, I want them to just say more stuff. Like, I've just sat at enough meals at my grandfather's house where it's just like, how's the weather? How's it going out there? This is terrible. Like, I just want more, you know, be more alive. That's what I want.
I agree. I'm mostly Italian. I'm a little Irish too, but my Italian side is definitely louder,
Yeah.
and we make it known when we speak. And it honestly makes it fun because it's almost like we're all trying to get a word in and we shout over each other at the same
Yeah.
time.
Yeah. And no, and I love that. It's like if something tastes delicious, say it, express it, like put it out there. So that is what I love about just the Mexican culture, but truthfully, even English people are you know, in love with food too. And I love an English breakfast, and I love fish and chips, and I love shepherd's pie, and so they're both good. They just show up very differently in the world. And I appreciate knowing both worlds, versus just one. Like, if I just had my Mexican culture, that'd be one thing. But I have both, and I'm very happy and proud of that.
Yeah, English, I feel like sometimes gets a bad rap for food. And I'm actually headed to London in a few weeks, and I'm like,
Ooh.
I've actually heard it's incredible. They have incredible food.
Oh my gosh. Love that.
Are you half of each? Are you
Yeah,
half
pretty
Mexican
much.
and half English?
Yeah, my grandma is Swedish. I have some, you know, a little bit of, like, there's a combination, but it's like all Anglo-English vibes.
Okay. Do you feel like when you finally kind of embrace that heritage, especially maybe even after you went to culinary school, that you're tied to the Mexican community here in LA? Because there's a pretty big community.
There is. I mean, I feel like I've always been tied to the Mexican culture in general. And then as I grew up, I started to find more and more people that were also Latin, that were also entrepreneurs. And so I kind of like built my own little crew. But I know some people are like, oh, I just am tapping into my culture as a Mexican woman later in life. I think I've always been tapped into it. Like, I knew in my soul
Good.
that that was my speed, and I just have kept trying to find ways to integrate it into my life, like moving to Mexico, getting married in Mexico City, you know, like going to culinary school later. All those things were just me just jamming more and more Mexican world into my life because I love it, and I love how it makes me feel, and I love how people feel when they go to Mexico. And like, look at Mexico City now. It's like this, you know,
Oh, I
epicenter of culture and art and perspective, and people go there to get inspired from all over the world. But it's like, it's the liveliness. You walk out of the airplane, and it's just like the sounds and the noise and the food stalls outside. It's just so, like, you know, prismacolor to the face. You're just like, wow, this is cool.
it is. I know Mexico City has been on my list forever, and I've just been dying to get there because I've heard people say the exact same things that you are. I was in San Antonio for Dia de los
Oh,
Muertos, and
cool.
it had that same kind of vibe. And it was just like I was looking around and everyone was doing something and everyone was just laughing and dancing and enjoying food and like being colorful because it was, the holiday and everything. And it was just like, and it wasn't even that. There was another layer to, of course, Dia de los Muertos, where it's like the appreciation for life and your lost loved ones and your current loved ones. And it was just like kind of life changing for me to see all of that difference, because I feel like sometimes we take everything for granted so much. So to just stop and then actually enjoy life like that is just such a insanely beautiful and captured thing.
Yes, that Mexico that, does, so. What you just said is one of the reasons I love my culture so much. It's like, it's not about how much money you have or where you live. It's like, are you appreciating the gusto of life and the people around you and the way that doesn't matter their status. Like, they enjoy themselves on Sunday. They get together as a family. They really lean into the non-money related things that just make you tick and make you come alive. And, you know, they go to church. And like my grandma was super Catholic, like deeply devout.
Okay.
Like rosary every night, you know, prayed. Mm-hmm. We had a million Virgin Mary candles, and it was like a beautiful thing because there was such a deep faith, and it gave her hope. And whatever it is that makes you tick, like do it and lean in. And she did, and everybody in Mexico does it, and it's just beautiful. Whereas here, we're just sometimes I think we lean in too much into like work and work and work and work, and then you're like, what else is that? And then you're not spending time with your family and friends because you're working. And so I've like gone through that and now kind of like exited the other side and recognized the prioritization component that's pretty key to just keeping all the like other stuff in your life important too. Don't just work till you die.
Yeah, no. And I think that's changing a lot because the grind mentality is just so unbelievably toxic at times. Yeah. I mean, of course you have to work hard. Like, I'll never say I'm a hard worker for sure. That's something my parents ingrained into me when I was young. But I don't think that working until you die is necessarily the way to go either.
And I'm like not particularly a fan of the word work-life balance, because I think balance is actually kind of like confusing, and people they think it should be perfect, and it's like a measuring cup, and it's like one third this, mm-hmm. one third that, one third. Did you do your bathtub tonight? Then your self-care is off. You're like, okay, hold on. It's not that. To me, it's about prioritization. So I think what I've done post becoming a mom is just prioritize where I spend my time and how I spend my time. So when I'm doing work, I'm like 1,000% working my ass off when I'm doing work. Mm-hmm. And then I know that I need to be home for bedtime by 6 p.m. And when it's bedtime, it's like, my phone is not out. I'm not doing emails while I'm trying to put my kid down. I'm prioritizing him at that moment. And having like learned to shut out different areas, but then fully dedicate myself versus being, you know, maybe more entitled and being like, well, I should be able to go to a spa all day in the middle of the week, all week long. It's like, that's not actually how you build something. You have to put in the time. So it's like appropriate volume of effort in chunks on different areas. And by doing that, get to like spend time with your husband and have a date where you're not doing anything but dating him for that moment. Putting your kid to bed, working really hard, and like separating it into buckets versus when I try to do everything all at once, it's a disaster. And the more structured and scheduled I am with the things I need to do, the more time I tend to have and the more successful I feel at the end of it versus trying to like have a Zoom call while rocking my baby while trying to make breakfast for my husband and then like nothing works.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could have had your baby in the Zoom call. That would have been fine too.
It's true. I could have.
Their first podcast debut. Oh, God.
No.
I really like that a lot though. The word balance is very, very tricky and confusing because you do automatically assume it's like 50-50. And then when you maybe lack of, for a better word, fail at doing 50-50, then you feel like you fail. Right. And it just is a constant roller coaster that you can't get off. And especially trying to take care of yourself. I know when I've grinded like for work and stuff, and you know, times are busier than others, but when I've not put self-care or cared about it quite honestly at all, that truly affects the amount of effort that I'm putting into work, my relationships, X, Y, Z. So it's just like such an individual, not choice, I don't think, but more of like an individual like recognition of what you're capable
of. And what your needs are at that time. Like there's, you know, I just wrapped a 4-month show doing a kitchen design.
I saw that.
Yeah. And it was so tremendously intense as far as scheduling. It was like 13 to 14 hour days.
And you're pregnant.
Yeah. And like, there was no, the prioritization was like, get this show done. I had to drop a bunch of other things, but I wasn't guilting myself because I wasn't doing my self-care bathtub every night, right? Like, it wasn't about that at that time. It was actually about accomplishing this greater goal that took a tremendous amount of effort. And the only way I was going to get that done is by giving it my full out, full court press effort. And when you set this like weird expectation that all of your great big goals are going to happen, even while you're sitting in your bathtub at home, self-caring yourself, it kind of like, it doesn't work. And then you're upset because you didn't accomplish that. But then you're like, right? You've seen these like funny memes on Instagram where it's like, I'm trying to take care of myself while I'm putting a face mask on and my hair is right. And they're like giving themselves more stress, trying to do all the things that they think are the expectation of how it is to take care of yourself, when really you just need to assess like, what is the goal at hand and how do you want to get there? And what do you need to deprioritize to get to prioritize the effort of this one thing? And I don't know, call me crazy, but that's how I've survived.
No, it's completely true. It is really stressful to feel like you have to check off every single box that, I don't know if necessarily it's a societal thing, but it kind of is, honestly, because you're seeing all of these people succeed at these different things. And, you know, in the age of the internet, you're seeing all these people do different things. And you're like, okay, well, I need to do this and I need to do that. And then if you don't, you feel like you're behind. So when so many people are telling you what to do, it's just like, you just got to live your life and figure out what works for you, because the rest is way too stressful and life is stressful enough.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Do what works for you. I got up at 6 a.m. to go swimming because that's what works for me and that's what zens me out. But maybe to somebody else, that's a terrible idea. And that's okay. It's like, you don't need to follow what everyone else is doing to get yourself to feel good. Like, do what works. Find the things that help you. And if the freaking bathtubs don't help you, then who cares? Don't do the damn bathtubs. Screw that kind of self-care. Like, but if that's what makes you feel great, I'm like, okay, all day, do your tubs. Like, everybody's on their own path. You've got to find the things that work for you.
I totally agree. I give you props for getting up at 6 a.m. though. I booked a 8 a.m. yoga class tomorrow and I'm like, I don't even know if I'll make it.
That's funny.
So early.
Got this, Olivia. You can do it.
Thank you. I believe in myself too. It's like, because then I wait until 1 p.m. or 2 p.m. to like exercise. And then I feel like that's just a terrible time of day, because that's when I get like, I need to work. But then I book some class or something.
Yeah, totally.
I would love to hear about your time doing culinary school in Mexico. What was it like? What were some of your biggest takeaways from learning there and immersing yourself in that?
It was hard because English is my first language. I grew up speaking Spanish too, but that was definitely like deeply out of my comfort zone when you're studying all kinds of things in Spanish. So it was definitely a challenge. It was not like some easy journey. And I actually studied so restaurant management at culinary school. So it was like food and management and restaurants and like how to deal with the whole infrastructure of it on top of food as a theory. And so it was kind of amazing because it taught me it was like the back of house and the front of house of a restaurant combined. And I had only ever thought about it as food. So it gave me like a really unique perspective that I appreciated a ton. And that then later on kind of, I guess, helped inseminate some of the seeds of like, oh, you could have a business that's related to food. That's not necessarily always food, but like even food has a back end of business. But I loved it. And, I did a bunch of internships out there. And just, again, being completely out of my comfort zone, being the only person from the U.S. in the program and having to struggle through it. Like, it was not for the faint of heart. And I really, it was a hard, hard journey. And I had to pay my way through it on my own. Like, it was just difficult. But I love that. Like, I think back to that and I'm like, I was building notches of confidence on my like life confidence belt. Like, it was just the hardship of it made me better in the long haul and just taught me how to be resilient and keep showing up even if I wanted to quit at times. And it was just like really not fun. And I still had to schlep it out there. I took an hour bus to get there and an hour bus to get home. And it was like, it was not some straightforward path. And I remember one exam that I took, I almost failed because it was all Excel spreadsheets and formulas in Spanish. And I was dying.
Oh God.
And I had to go and ask to take the test again. And I had to like get a tutor and really lean in because I just couldn't do everything at the velocity that the other people were doing it because they had learned everything in Spanish and I hadn't. So, you know, there were bumps. And I say that because just when you're in those moments, like, don't quit. Lean in and keep showing up and then get to the other side. Like, don't quit your yoga class in the middle of the class. That's just dumb. You already drove there. The outfit is on. Like, finish sweating. You know what I mean? Like, finish the damn class.
Yeah, I totally agree with that too. I just in comparison to workout classes, even like when I am halfway through, I'm like, you put your clothes on, you drove here, your teacher is right there. She's going to help you. Like, just finish. And your legs make me shaking, but like I finish it and you know you're going to feel good after, but the process sometimes sucks.
The sausage being made is never comfortable. If I think about the show that I finished, there were days where I was so beyond exhausted that I couldn't really get up in the morning. I was just like, I don't even know how to, what am I, like, I saw the edge. Like, I'd never seen the edge in my life. I've always just been such a hard worker. And I was like, oh my God, that's the edge. There it is. Holy shit. And I had to just realize I needed to take some time. So I like asked for a couple of days off just to like recalibrate, go swimming, eat enough, sleep enough, recognizing that I needed a second to kind of like pull myself together. But it was so intense, but it was my dream and it had been a dream of mine for a long time. So I couldn't just quit. I couldn't just be like, oh, sorry, 17 people that have now signed up for the show or, you know, the network that hired us and booked everything. Like, oh, I'm just too tired now. Like, that is bullshit. Just remember, when you have the dream, you go through the hard work to accomplish the dream. And no one has done it any other way than doing the work.
Mm-hmm. And it's important to recognize, and it takes a lot of strength to recognize that you need a break sometimes, especially just to recuperate so that you can put 100% into what you're doing and accomplish that dream. And I do want to get into the design show in a bit more in a bit, but I want to talk about after culinary school, you went on to cook in professional LA kitchens. So I've talked to a lot of chefs who have thrived in that workspace and, you know, many who haven't. And what was that experience like for you? Did you find that you were thriving in that because you enjoy like the business end and the food end, or what was your experience?
I mean, I like failed miserably and I thrived. It was a combination. There were days where I'd go home crying, and then there were days where I'm like, I killed it today. It was such a vicious roller coaster of feelings and emotions because it's a professional kitchen and it was a 2 Michelin star kitchen. So it wasn't like for the faint of heart. There was so much didn't know, but there was also so much I was learning simultaneously and like life lessons, not just like, this is how you brunoise something. It was like, you know, again, layers of the resilience and layers of like when everything is going wrong and you have 100 tickets pouring in like an episode of The Bear and you literally want to run out the back door, you don't, and you keep going forward. And just going through an experience like that over and over again, man, you can't learn that in school. You will never learn that in an MBA. That teaches you like just gut-wrenching boss moves of like, don't give up. And that was huge. That was huge for me to be able to go and start a business because the amount of times that shit hit the fan so hard in Headley and Bennett land that I just kept showing up the next day. Like I learned from being in the kitchen, having tickets pouring on our heads and still having to figure it out. So I loved it. I really did. And probably because I'm a total weirdo, but the adrenaline that I got from being in service, which is essentially when it's like 6 o'clock, the guests start arriving and it's go time. You're not prepping food. You're actually like making the food for the night. It's like two parts of a restaurant, right? Everyone comes in early. You prep all the ingredients, do the mise en place. And then 6 o'clock or 5:30 restaurant time, restaurant guests arrive. Like that to me was so thrilling because you were like preparing for a football game. You're about to go out there and like tackle everything coming your way. And you felt so accomplished at the end of the night. And that was a beautiful thing. And I still miss it. I have deep nostalgia for those days.
Well, maybe one day when your show takes off and, you know, you already have a successful business, you can revisit it in the future in some sort of way. But I always use the bear as a relatability point because I haven't been in the kitchen, but it just gave me such an appreciation for the amount that you're able to handle at that time. And they do, a lot of the chefs do enjoy the thrill of all of that. I mean, it's an exciting thing to like work so hard on something and have people enjoy it and give you a good response. It's really hard though when you're like the consumer and you go into a restaurant and you just order food. You don't really think about how hard the people are necessarily working in the back. You're just thinking, oh, when's my food going to come out? Is it going to be good? Yeah. Okay, bye. Yeah. Yeah. Next. Oh, no, totally. You know?
And when you have the context of like, oh, that dish I just had actually took 11 hours to make and was flown in from Japan and that was from Italy, and it gives you a lot more perspective on just the hard work that goes into so much stuff that we do every day. And it makes you think about, you know, in our case, like our employees and our team, sometimes people are like, oh my God, $85 for an apron. And I'm like, yeah, it took 13 people to make that apron.
I didn't think that was that expensive.
No, I mean, now it's like the standard thing. But when I first started, it was radical. It was really radical to people to be buying an $85 product. But because we've done it with such high quality materials and have always leaned into like the craftsmanship of it, I have people that still own a heavily amended apron from year one and it's 11 years later. I'm like, yes, that to me is building something beautifully, but it's because we cared about all the details. And when people realize how many details are going on behind the scenes, they understand like, oh, okay. So the $85 is actually, it's like buying a Le Creuset Dutch oven. You're going to have that thing forever, right? It is just like it's an investment. It's not fast fashion. You are buying heritage quality brands. And that's what all of Hedley and Bennett has been built upon. It's like heritage quality with a community guiding it and teaching it like what it needs.
Knowing that you created Hedley and Bennett in 2012, when did you have that aha moment that there needs to be like more durable and practical aprons out there? When did you notice that gap?
It was pretty instantaneous. It wasn't like I worked on a business plan for 3 years. It's like it was 2012 and I started it in 2012. It was almost like simultaneous.
Oh,
and everything I learned was by getting orders and then tweaking and fixing them along the way and listening, really deeply listening to our community. And I wrote a book called Dream First, Details Later during COVID. And it was just the whole story of how I built this out of nothing with $300 out of my house. And the community factor is such a huge part of it. Because if I wasn't willing to listen to every mistake I made, I couldn't have adapted the product as quickly as I did. So it's like, oh, your apron, I loved the ones you made for me for my restaurant. But you know what? The pocket, I'm not loving the placement and the way the strap cuts into my neck. Like, I actually don't like that. Mm-hmm. I could have just ignored that. But instead, every time I got feedback, I tweaked. Yeah. So now the product is like near perfect, but I tweaked it for 9+ years. Like, you know, so it's having that like long game mentality and willingness to hear what you're doing wrong along the way that's allowed us to still be a brand today and allowed us to expand into other categories because our community knows we're listening. And if they say we want a knife, we're like, well, what do you want about a knife? Why do you like a knife? How can we make you a better knife than what exists out there? And you know, the collaboration begins.
Right. And it's a real constructive criticism if you're able to take it, and it is constructive, that can really make or break a brand. Because if you just kept plugging along, we're like, screw you, I'm gonna do what I want, this is the apron I like, whatever, I'm not gonna take your tips, it probably would not have been as successful as it is.
No, today. And it also taught us how to do collaborations with huge brands, because we've collaborated with chefs for so many years, and then it became not just a chef, it became Vans or Crocs or Grateful Dead or Love Shack Fancy, or, you know, the list went on and on. But it started with learning how to do it, how to like crawl in collaborating, and then leap and then jump and, you know, run.
I saw some of those collaborations. They looked really, really cool. They're very out of the box. And I think that's very smart.
Yeah. I'm sure we definitely, we try and do things where you're like, what? Whoa, that's cool. Grateful Dead. Oh my God. Awesome. Or
that is so crazy. Grateful really Dead fun. Is a cool one.
But then we went from like Grateful Dead to, I think it was like Love Shack Fancy, which is a Hamptons very floral, girly, over the top brand that is very different from us. And so by keeping it really unusual and different, it's like we're tapping into totally different worlds and each bringing something to the table that the other one doesn't have. If you're collaborating with people that are like exactly like the same as you, again, to the point of like Mexican and English culture, it's not exciting. But if you have two totally different worlds merging, it's like, oh damn, I like that.
And it keeps them on their toes. Everyone's
it makes like magic. It's a little bit, it's just unique. Like you'd never get those two points of view in the same place. And now all of a sudden you've got like two friends who you'd never imagine dating. And you're like, whoa, I love this.
That has happened several times in my
friend groups. There you go. So you know.
I know. The Crocs is smart though. Crocs are making a big comeback. So that's a good one that you guys did.
I mean, they're crushing it, those guys. And that was fun because we took a very chef-oriented approach. Like, how do we make them comfortable and cool and good colors for the restaurant? But then they have all of their own funny, awesome details. And so we were able to like bring our different, our different perspectives to the table.
I love that. I would love to see a chef come out to my restaurant table in Crocs. That would be incredible.
Oh, girl, it will happen. It will happen.
Yes, I want that. You mentioned you wrote the book. You're leaning right into my questions here, which I love. named Dream First, Details Later, How to Quit Overthinking and Make It Happen. So you mentioned, you know, you were listening to your community, but what about you when you were going through this process? How did you quit overthinking and make it happen?
I've always been very pro action. And, you know, I think that at times it has definitely bit me in the ass because I'm just like so quick to get to the next thing that I'll just roll into it. But I've also found that in the time that I could have overthought it, I already tried three times and I failed twice. And then I figured it out on the third time. So there's like a healthy balance to it. And I think I just have this like deep willingness to fail. I'm like okay with it. And I learn from it. And then I'm like, what did I do wrong? And I might feel like shit and all the things. It's not like I don't feel bad when I fail. I just am willing to fail. That's the difference. And you just like, if you're willing to fail, it's a little less scary. And then when you do fail, you're like, okay, what did I do? How can I do it again? And you get back up one more time. And then you succeed. You're like, hell yes. Okay, cool. So I've just been very aggressive with that concept. And the book breaks it all down. Like, how did I get customers? How did I show up to events and just talk to people relentlessly and not be afraid to have people say no? And you know, when they do say no, don't get discouraged. Keep finding other people to talk to. Like, there's billions of people on the planet. Go find somebody that will listen to you, and eventually someone will. And just sticking to that has, it's just been really helpful for me.
I find that too, in my personal experience, that when I am a classic overthinker, textbook overthinker, textbook anxiety, whatever. When I dive headfirst into something without thinking about it, it honestly ends up working out. Because when I am constantly like picking my nails, overthinking, asking everyone else's their opinions, it's like nothing's ever going to get done. And I'm actually never going to achieve what I want to achieve.
Right.
So sometimes you have to just throw yourself in and see what works, see what doesn't, see what fails, and then adjust.
Exactly. And it's better to just get something basic out there and learn what people say about it than being like, so I have this idea and it looks like this and it's shaped like this, but I don't know if I should do it. And everyone's just like, what is she talking about? Versus you just leaning in saying, okay, well, here's what I'm thinking. It looks like this. I know it's not perfect. Like, our first aprons were horrible. Those aprons were so bad. But if I had sat there and analyzed it forever, like, who knows when I would have launched it, right? So I think my major message is, if you have an idea, like, get it to a basic status point, just basic, and ship it. See what people think. Start listening and then leaning into the feedback. And then, as you said, adapt and adjust and carry forward. And I think the more you stare at something, the scarier it becomes. But if you just run into it, you're just like, let's go. Let's try. Just show up. Okay. Oh, I want to get into a CPG company. I want to start a CPG brand. Okay. I'm going to go to this show called Expo West and I'm going to walk the show. Great. Like, you're already there before you even thought about, oh my gosh, how am I going to raise money? How am I going to market this? Like, that's, you're getting in over your skis if you're starting to worry about all those things. So just show up and then keep going.
Right, right. I much rather fall flat on my face quicker than it being a slow burn and me overthinking every single thing.
Totally.
But honestly, I'm curious too, like, what are some of the biggest hurdles you faced emotionally when you were going through all this? Did people call you crazy? Were they like, your aprons, you know, since your first one you said wasn't the best?
Yeah.
Were they like, oh, that's never going to work?
No, definitely. I think there's a lot of just, until they see it come to life, they don't believe it. And you kind of have to like build it. And then people are like, oh, that's beautiful. I like that. But they have to see something alive. So it was a big amount of, a large amount of me just kind of putting my blinders on a lot. And to be honest, like, I really want to be liked by people. Like, I really want to be friends with our community. And when I failed somebody because an order didn't go right or something like that, I was devastated. Like, it's not like I'm just so resilient that everything rolls off my shoulders and I don't care.
Right.
Like, I deeply took it to heart when something went wrong. And I had to just like continue to get up the next day because I knew I was the only one carrying my little torch with my little flame was like right here in my hand. So if I laid down, that torch went down too. And that's been just a big hard challenge of like, how do I get less emotional about things that go wrong? And, you know, at the beginning, it's like, if I had an employee who was no longer going to be with the company, I took it very personally. And over the years, I realized that, like, I had this business coach who was really smart. And she said, you know, people are going to get on the bus and they're going to get off the bus. And it's part of the journey. And you actually should be, like, appreciative of it and absolutely, like, willing to champion those people getting off the bus if it's the right thing for them. Versus before, I was like, wait, but this is my dream. Like, why don't you want to be a part of this dream? And getting, like, too in my head about it. And so... By having that perspective when someone goes or you need to separate from that employee because maybe they're not delivering what you need anymore as a business, having that point of view has really helped me. And it just is more like, okay, it's business. Like, this is not helpful for them anymore. They're not learning or growing. And it's not like you're keeping somebody on because you think they're amazing, but they're no longer doing their job. And then it's affecting the entire company. So you're sort of harming more people by keeping someone on because of your emotional response. So that's been a big one of just like on the bus, off the bus, their phases, their seasons, and people change and people's needs change and people's personal lives change. And you got to be okay with adapting to where they're at. And that also helped me realize that, like, when I had Nico, my first son, another son, he's still inside though. he comes out in 2 weeks. But you know, with Nico, I realized I needed to, you know, bring in a whole other level of expertise and experience to the business, and that I didn't have that anymore. And so I hired a CEO, and that president, and then a CEO. And so that was like a whole change where I had to let go of, it was my season to get off the bus in a way, right? Like, I was no longer the driver. I was now a passenger on the bus. And that was challenging, but it helped the business go to the next level. So you can't let team members or yourself hold you back. You got to do the right thing to kind of get to that next stage.
That's really, really difficult to give up something you've worked so hard on for 10 plus years to someone else and trusting them with it. That's hard.
Yeah.
And finding the right person who not only shares your vision, but can elevate it.
Yeah.
As well. It's like, that's definitely a tough thing to do. And I think as far as the emotions in business goes, like there's a place for it and it isn't. So I really do like the bus analogy a lot. I feel like seeing your employees as people and understanding that they do have these other personal issues or they do have changes just like any one of us versus like seeing them as a number.
Yeah.
Or something, that's what's going to take you farther is just choosing the right people and recognizing when it's their time to leave and when it isn't.
Yeah.
I like the bus analogy a lot, though. I think that's really, really smart. Your kitchen design show I want to talk about now with the aid of Andrew Zimmern, who I love.
Oh, he's the best.
If you're able, I would love to hear more about the upcoming show. What's the premise of it?
Yeah.
Is this something you saw on the horizon when you created Headley and Bennett all those years ago?
I definitely feel like I've had my version of manifesting it in the world for a long time. Like I wanted a show that I could have cooking and some element of design, whether it was setting a table or something. Like I've had inklings of it, which in so many ways is kind of like Headley and Bennett began as an apron company, but it was like custom order. And now we're selling knives and we're a culinary brand. And I wouldn't have figured out those things if I didn't start walking down the path. And so this show, Andrew and I have been talking for years about doing something together, and we would have a concept and we'd talk about it with people and it just wouldn't quite land. And then COVID happened. Like, I feel like every network in the world got blown up and then like everything reset. And then the stars aligned last year. And I'd been in Headley and Bennett land for 11 years, redesigning the way people look and feel in a kitchen professionally. And I was like, oh my God, if I could do this in home kitchens, what a beautiful extension of what I've already been doing. And it's so selfishly for me, how fun that I get to go in, redesign a kitchen through the lens of a chef, and then also make it look amazing too. So it wasn't just like the functionality, it was the function backed with like an amazing before and after. And so I got to tap into this other whole other layer of myself that my husband Casey and I have been, you know, getting properties and remodeling them just on our fun spare time forever. And we love design through Headley and Bennett. In life, we're always building or doing something, whether it's our kitchen or a bedroom or our little house in Joshua Tree, whatever it is, we're always creating something. And this was like a smash up of all those things. So it comes out May 28th. It's on Taste Made.
Yay!
Yeah. Very soon. It's coming out on Taste
Made. Is that known?
Yes, it is. May 28th.
Okay.
So yes, it's known. Okay. And then there's talks with a streamer so that it would go. I can't say the name of the streamer, but that's a conversation that's like in the middle of happening. But yeah, it's like really nerdy. It's kind of like the home edit meets the bear a little.
I love it.
Like very.
Wait, I love it. That's so exciting.
Yeah, it's fun. I can't wait. And I just, you know, after you watch it, you literally want to go and redo something in your kitchen. You're like, oh shit, I didn't realize I could do that to my pantry or my spices or my fridge or the way I organize my pots and pans or how I put my butter out. Like all of it. It's just head to toe nerdiness in a fun way.
I love that. You're going to see me like making videos of me rearranging my entire kitchen.
It's very cathartic. It's very therapeutic to make something look and feel good. And then it's like organized. Oh, it's the best.
Mm-hmm. Especially my spices.
Oh my God.
My spices are very important to me and they have to be organized.
Yes.
In order.
It helps. It makes you feel so much better.
Mm-hmm. I love Andrew though. It seems like you guys have a wonderful relationship and, you know, you said you've been in contact with him for a long time now and he's been in the food game for forever, I feel like. So I'd love to know if there's any advice he's given you along the way that's kind of stuck with you.
You know, I think what I've learned from Andrew is like the ability to evolve. He's never just kind of stuck to one thing. And from when I met him to where he is today, like, his arc of change has been tremendous. And I love that about him. It's not like, here's the one thing and lean into it forever and never do anything different. He's embraced shifting and adapting and changing and heartache and all these things that has just made him a really like an amazing friend, but also like a mentor, somebody to look up to and realize like that's what happens when you lean into the discomfort of a shift.
He has. He really has. He's an incredible teacher. Yeah. Truly. He's I've talked to him a few times through interviews, but I finally got to meet him in person a few weeks ago because normally everything was virtual and all that stuff. But I saw him do a cooking demo, and the way he engaged the audience was crazy. It was just like they were all so captivated by what he was saying, and I was too. And I was like, I forgot I was a journalist there for a second. I was like, this is so cool.
Yeah. No, he has such a beautiful sparkle while he's teaching you, and it doesn't feel like you're, you know, being fed broccoli. You're just like, oh my God, this is so much fun. Right. He makes it really, like no matter who you are, he makes you feel important. And when he first met me, I was like a fledgling little tiny company, and he made me feel so special. And we were friends from then on. And I never thought like, oh my gosh, it's Andrew. Like, he's too important, too big. Like, he always made me feel like I could call him about anything. And that's a really beautiful way to make people feel.
Yeah, I actually really agree with that. He even made me feel like that. And I've only talked to him like a handful of times. And he was like, I always say to put a face to the name. He remembered me very well. And I was like, not a lot of people are able to do that. Yeah. And I'm definitely impressed.
Totally.
He humbled me on one phone call because I asked him what a very, very general question of what is your favorite like spring recipes that are coming up or something. It was something like that. And he was like, well, I've been doing this for X amount of years. And I was like, you're so right. I was like, there's too many things out here. That was a bad question.
Yeah.
It's funny. But that's really exciting. Do you feel like you were able to transition into television host mode really well?
I feel like I figured it out pretty quickly, but I also had an incredible team coaching me along the way. And our showrunner is a beast, and her name's Tracy Finley. And she just like, anytime I didn't nail something, she's like, okay, let's try that again. What about this? And it was so comfortable that I just kind of didn't get in my own way. I didn't get in my head because we were running so fast. And so for all of the lack of knowing how to do something, because we were moving so quickly, I was just like, we were all building the plane together and being willing to say, I don't know how to do that. What do you think I should do? And that really helped. We were just really transparent about, we're doing something that's very different from a typical show. This is not your standard design show. So there is no manuscript on how to do it. We have to just like embrace that there's organization beats, there's functionality beats, there's chef beats that have never been discussed at a kitchen level. And we have to now take the time to document that along the way. And we didn't always know how to do it. And we just did it anyway. And I think that's where magic happens. Like, it just shedding your way through a forest. Like, you're like, I don't know what I'm going to find, but I'm going to keep walking Fritz. I'm going to keep walking straight.
Yeah. And that's what's going to make it unique, right? Kind of seeing how that entire process works and seeing at least the audience seeing something that hasn't really been done before. Yeah. That'll be really fun. Congratulations on all of that. So let's talk about what's next for you. You've had unexpected collaborations. You have stuff going on in your personal life. You have a show coming out. Is there anything else you'd like to mention or upcoming projects?
I mean, gosh, what else is there? There's some pretty amazing things we're doing in Headley and Bennett Land that have to do with new product extensions that are pretty major. That's coming out in about a month. Just without saying what it is, think of like everything you need to cook that isn't a pot or a pan.
Got it. Like, leave it there.
Other tools that you need to cook.
I got some ideas rolling.
That we've been working on for a long time. So that's pretty exciting. But yeah, that will happen very soon. And then, of course, the show. And we have a pretty cool collaboration happening with the NFL at the end of the summer.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So that's awesome.
All right. So I have a short game for you if you're up for it. It's like a lightning round. So I'm going to do two I did kind of primarily Mexican foods, but not really. They're more just like food trends and whatever else. You're going to tell me if it's a smash or pass kind of deal.
Yes.
First one. This one should be easy. Chips and guac.
Yes. Hard, hard. What would you say? Yes or pass? Smash. Okay. Yes. I would smash it. I would smash it.
Second one, buffalo chicken fajitas.
Ooh. Oh God. I guess it depends on the day and the craving and if I'm pregnant or not, but if I'm where I'm at right now, I would go for the buffalo chicken.
I love fajitas. Sometimes I forget about them and they reappear in my life. And I'm like,
I love fajitas, but I love carne asada, and I'll take carne asada over fajitas, even though I know they're like similar, but different. So that's why.
Yeah. I do too. Yeah. No, I like that too. That's definitely my first choice. All right. Third one, loaded nachos, like to the max loaded nachos.
Yes, absolutely. To the max. Like, three times the height of the, you know, the chip.
Yes, four times, like five
everything
times
on there. Yes, definitely.
All right, this fourth one is maybe it's controversial. I don't know. The Mexican pizza from Taco Bell.
Yes, all day. I love Taco Bell. It's weird. I have like a weird love affair with Taco Bell because I'm very anti-fast food and I eat pretty healthy most of the time, but I have a deep love for Taco Bell.
That's funny. You want to know something crazy? I've never had Taco Bell in my entire life.
Well, congratulations. That's pretty amazing. I actually like Mexican pizza. I do. And I like their crunchy taco. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I like from them.
Yeah, I honestly, I'm not like opposed to it. I'm not really, I just never have craved fast food and I don't know why, except for like, are you from the East Coast? No, you're from LA. I don't know why I asked that. I knew that. I'm from the East Coast and we used to have Dutch's, which is like a chain kind of thing. And I used to get like hamburgers and milkshakes from there. And that I would crave. But for some reason, I think my parents just like never took me to like McDonald's or Taco Bell. And I just like, it's just like meh to me. But I heard the Mexican pizza is good.
It's pretty good. One day, if you're in a pickle, you should try it.
Okay, perfect. All right. Fifth one. I think we touched upon this earlier. Flour tortillas.
Versus corn.
Versus corn, yeah.
Oof. I think I'm going to say corn. I would smash the corn more than the flour. But that's just because I grew up with corn tortillas and really good ones. But there's a time and a place for great flour tortillas, too. Don't get me wrong. I love a good, delicious, melty flour tortilla with a little bit of butter and salt. Oh, my God. My mouth is watering.
They're so good. I know. You're going to crave all this stuff after. Exactly. All right. My final question for you that I ask every guest is if there is one cooking appliance or utensil that you think everyone should splurge on, what would it be and why?
A good knife. A sharp knife. Mm-hmm. Everybody. I don't care if you have the crappiest stove in the world or if your pans suck. Like, you need a good sharp knife because it makes the cooking experience fundamentally better. And literally the heavily embedded knife that we created is based on the original knife that I worked with when I started, being a cook professionally. Uh-huh. And it's just like, it's such an empowering feeling when you go from having like the crappy culinary school knife to a good, proper Japanese steel knife that's super sharp, holds its edge, looks good, feels good in your hand, isn't too heavy, like all the things. And you really just need a chef's knife, you need a bread knife, and you need a utility or a paring knife, and that's it. Like, you don't need the giant blocks of 15 knives. You need three core knives that are high quality, sharp, call it a day. And if I'm being biased here, Hedley and Bennett knives.
I was gonna say, it all comes back around. I upgraded my knife this year and it was life-changing, so I do promote that and endorse it for sure. Thank you so much for coming on and telling me all about your story and all of your success. I'm excited to see the show that's coming out and all of your other things. So thank you for coming on. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh my gosh, this was such a fun conversation. Thank you for having me. I can't wait for you to see our top secret situation launching in a month and a half. Keep your ojos peeled.
Okay, okay. Just send me like a letter that says top secret and then
top secret. It's here. Yep, I'll do that.
I love it. I love it. So you can keep up with Ellen's latest project on Instagram at Ellen Marie Bennett, or check out Hedley and Bennett at www.hedleyandbennett.com.
Hey, fellow foodies. Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to leave me a review. While you're at it, make sure to follow me at livinforfoodpod on Instagram or TikTok, or email me at livinforfoodpod@gmail.com. Let me know what you're cooking up this week, which guests you would like to see on the podcast, or tell me your opinions on the latest viral food trend. And in case you're just joining me, there is an entirety of season 1 ready and waiting for you. Until next time.